I'd like to welcome everyone out to the session with Todd Compton on his experience writing Fire and Sword. Todd is co-author with Leland Gentry of Fire and Sword, A History of the Latter-day Saints in Northern Missouri, 1836-39. Published this year by Greg Coford Books. Todd's currently researching a biography of Indian missionary Jacob Hamlin. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with his wife and two sons. To earn his daily bread, Todd works with computers in a law firm. I actually met Todd back in Concord in Sunstone, 1988, and was blown away at his graciousness. He presented a paper for a friend at the time, and Ed Ashmont was the respondent. And Todd was wonderful. And since then, I've followed his career through all of his books and articles, and I'm indebted to Todd for his broad scope in writing history. Todd's sympathetic. When he wrote Sacred Loneliness, I was amazed at how he could put himself into the lives of these women who were, in my opinion, abused by a system. And Todd was articulate and sympathetic and loving to those women, and I appreciated that. I'm also blown away at the fact that he can have two small children and still be productive and do great work in the historical community and have to work outside of the historical community. To me, that's an amazing accomplishment. I'd like to turn the time over to Todd Compton for his paper.
Joe is my press agent. So. No, he's very kind and gracious, and a good friend. Does anyone have a copy of Fire and Sword?
Oh, I'll be right back. I'll run and get one.
I just wanted to raise it up to show it to you. I left mine home. No one here. Okay, rush out and get it after. Okay, after this session.
Yes.
It looks like Joe's going to go get one. Okay, so this is a kind of a expansion of something I published in a blog, if any of you have run across that. Sorry to duplicate it a little bit. But I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience working on editing this book and being kind of a co-author. And in addition, talk a little bit about what I brought to the project as opposed to what Gentry wrote originally. So here goes. A few years ago, I agreed to edit and update Leland Gentry's path-breaking 1958 PhD thesis on the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri, little knowing the long path I was starting on. And by the way, if any of you have published books, my experience has been they usually come out about 3 years after you expect them. You know? And this book came out about 6 years after I expected it to come out. Gentry had contracted with Greg Coffert to publish his thesis, but health problems prevented him from updating it as he had originally hoped. So I had contact with Greg Coffert, and this is what it looks like. It's a nice big tome. And I had contact with Greg Coffert and Levina Fielding Anderson, who was working as an editor with Greg Coffert, and I never had contact with Gentry. But he had very severe health problems. He'd always wanted to update his thesis and was never able to do it. So Leland agreed that Greg could get someone to work on it. And for various reasons, I ended up being that person. And to my regret, I never met Leland Gentry. And he died on August 6, 2007. And I wondered, as I got going on the project, am I a little bit too liberal for Gentry, and who was a lifetime member of the CES system. But Greg told me that he agreed, he agreed to have me do the project. And early on, I decided to leave Gentry's text substantially as it was, aside from minor editing. And I should say that when this was published in 1958, very little scholarly work on Mormons in Missouri in the 1838 war had been done. And so his PhD thesis was really a wonderful foundational work. Okay, and so I was updating it, you know, how many years later? Like half a millennium later. And I decided to leave his text substantially as it was. Otherwise, I would have gone in and had to would have read all the primary sources myself and totally rewritten it myself. It would have been my book, and I didn't want that to happen. Okay, but I wanted to contribute and update. And I had seen cases of authors who updated in another author's book and entirely changed the thesis of the book, and I didn't want to do that. So I made it clear when I was writing in my own voice. And in my updating, I added footnotes, marked this coming from me, and addenda at the end of chapters. And in the addenda, I sometimes summarized scholarly debates that took place in the wake of Gentry's thesis. And I was helped by two excellent books on the 1838 war, Stephen LeSueur's The 1838 Mormon War in Missouri, published in 1987, and Alexander L. Baugh's A Call to Arms, The 1838 Mormon Defense of Northern Missouri, published in 2000, which had originally been another thesis. And sometimes I examined issues, did research, and wrote from my own point of view. And I came to have a lot of respect for Gentry's exhaustive survey of the Mormon War, which dealt with many difficult issues in a scholarly, skillful way for the first time. And I think his balance is remarkable. He was a committed Latter-day Saint, worked in the church educational system throughout his lifetime, and obviously looked at Mormons in Missouri sympathetically. But it was important to him to also look at the 1838 conflict from the point of view of non-LDS old settlers, in the sense of settlers who had been there before the Mormons came. And Joe has pointed out that often these old settlers were quite young men. And what did you say, Boggs was like 40?
I think 41 or 42, something yeah. like And he was the old man. 42.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. 42. Okay.
And it's also, of course, really striking when we look at these early Mormon general authorities, how young they were, the early apostles and so on. Okay, well, in today, you know, the leaders of the church, they get that way through a lot of seniority, you know. And so when they become members of the Quorum of the Twelve, they're usually in their 50s, 60s, so on. Okay. Gentry critiqued B.H. Roberts and Andrew Jensen because they're, who are kind of official Mormon historians, because their treatments of the 1838 Mormon War failed, quote, to present the non-Mormon point of view to any significant extent. And this kind of complexity and viewpoint is one of the characteristics of good history, which goes beyond portraying people as perfect heroes in white hats and absolute villains in black hats. And that's one of the really typical ways of looking at the Mormons in Missouri. And you simply see the Mormons as total victims and the non-Mormons as totally evil. And in fact, it was a lot more complex than that. So what was involved in my minor editing of the text? Once or twice, there were dates that were wrong in the text, and I corrected them. In addition, I simplified some of the language occasionally to make it less formal. Then the entire manuscript was edited. Then when I got it where I thought it was perfect, then it went to Levina Fielding Anderson. I found out it really wasn't perfect. And sometimes she suggested style changes, again, usually to make the language less formal, so it would read more smoothly. And other times she asked that I research specific points. And for example, often a non-Mormon in Gentry's text was identified only by his last name. Levina asked me to find the full name when possible. I found that usually the primary source that Gentry had quoted only had the last name. That's why Gentry only gave the last name. But with a little digging, sometimes I was able to find the full name, and often when I did this, I found the man's life history, which gave me greater insight into the role he played before, during, and after the 1838 war. So this was a very useful exercise, and those full names will help other researchers later, hopefully. In addition, Gentry often makes long quotations from primary texts. I like this kind of documentary approach, but since 1958, new, better, more exact publications of primary texts have been made, such as Dean Jesse's books of Joseph Smith texts, Cannon and Cook's Far West Record, Clark V. Johnson's Mormon Redress Petitions, and now we're starting to get the Joseph Smith papers published by the church, the LDS Church. As I worked through this process of editing, updating, summarizing scholarly work on Missouri, a number of themes struck me. And these are some of the things I wrote about in my addenda. And the first one I'm going to talk about, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on. Okay, and so that I'll go through a number of them. But the first one is simply the phrase, "Nits make lice." Mm-hmm. As I was dealing with the Hansmill Massacre, of course, that's a very famous phrase that one of the non-Mormons used, killing a Mormon boy. And so I wanted to know, is there a background for this phrase in American history?
Say it again, Todd.
Nits make lice?
Nits make lice.
Yeah. In other words, I guess nits are the insects in the small version, and then they grow up and become lice.
They're basically like the egg, I think, is what it is.
A little further, right?
Is it? Yeah. I know they attach, but they're awful. Yeah. The point is they're bad.
Okay. And I found, after doing my research, that it was used prominently in Indian massacres to justify killing children or babies of Indians, and women of Indians, too. And this shows how minorities were often demonized in 18th and 19th century America. It's kind of a way of looking at the person you're killing, the children, kind of looking at them as insects. And one example I found was Tom Quick, and his name is the Indian Slayer, who lived from 1734 to 1796 in Sullivan County, New York. Tom's father and several relatives had been killed in a war with the Delaware Indians. After the war ended and a peace treaty had been signed, Tom, who had vowed to exterminate, and notice that word exterminate there, he vowed to exterminate all Delawares from the region in which he lived. And one day he discovered one of the Delawares with his family in the wilderness. So this is a long quote here. Tom, after killing the Indian, killing the father, tomahawked the squaw and her children, her older children. As the hatchet sunk into the brain of the squaw, she sprang instinctively towards her youngest child and fell on the bottom of the canoe and was soon beyond the pale of mortal life. The two oldest children, as Tom, this is an 1851 history of Tom Quick. The two oldest children, as Tom afterwards declared, squawked like young crows as he killed them. He then proceeded thus far without any compunctions of conscience or feeling that he was committing a most horrible massacre, which ranked him with incarnate demons. But when he came to the youngest, his murderous propensities were for a moment checked. As he raised the tomahawk to give the fatal blow, the babe, for it was nothing more, looked up wonderingly into his face and smiled. The innocence and unconsciousness of danger beaming into its sunny, childish eyes caused him to relent. His arm fell to his side. He did not strike it. At the moment, the idea of taking the life of such an innocent, harmless being seemed horrible to him. It held out its tiny hands to him, and in childish glee, seemed as if it would spring to his arms. Tom's heart was completely softened. He thought he would convey it to some white family and have it taken care of properly, and fancied that it would be very pleasant to have such a pretty, innocent creature to fondle after he had been hunting and when he returned to the settlements. But the fact suddenly thrust itself into his mind that the child would, in a few years, become an Indian, and this so enraged him that he instantly dashed out its brains. End quote. Since Tom retold the story repeatedly, he was apparently proud of his deed and considered killing the baby a moral act. He went on to become a folk hero in old New York. Quote from the same source, Tom did not relate the foregoing facts until it was safe for him to do so. Previous to his death, he repeatedly told them to Jacob Quick, Esquire of Calicoon. When asked why he killed the children, His invariable reply was, "Nits make lice." Okay, second example. In 1864, the phrase "nits make lice" was used in the infamous Sand Creek Massacre about 40 miles from Fort Lyon in southeastern Colorado. Under Black Kettle, known as a peace leader, about 500 Cheyennes and Arapahos made a winter camp at Sand Creek. After concluding a peace treaty with the U.S. government in September 1864, the group considered themselves under the protection of the government and flew a white flag and an American flag over their camp. However, on November 29th, 1864, Colonel John M. Chivington, a Civil War hero, at the head of about 700 volunteer Colorado militia, suddenly attacked the peaceful encampment of Indians, killing about 150 to 200 of them, the great majority women and children and elderly. Chivington reportedly told his troops, "Kill and scalp all, big and little, nits make lice." Even though Chivington was forced to resign his militia position afterwards, and his political career was finished, he became a hero to local whites, and a town near the massacre site was named after him. Many of the bodies of the Indians were mutilated, and parts of them were displayed to cheering crowds in Denver. Chivington, like Quick, viewed this massacre as a moral good and frequently told the story of his part in the massacre. A former Methodist minister, he was known as the Fighting Parson. He reportedly said, "I have come to kill Indians, and I believe it is right and honorable to use any means under God's heaven to kill Indians." End quote. Then there is the Ash Hollow Massacre in September 1855 on the Platte in Nebraska, in which General William S. Harney killed at least 86 innocent Indians, half of whom were women and children, after Harney raised a flag of truce. Representative James Kavanaugh in 1870, I'm jumping around here, after Brevet Colonel Eugene M. Baker massacred Piegan Indians, including women and children, in Montana, Kavanaugh defended Baker by saying, in the words of General Harney after the Battle of Ash Hollow, when he was assailed for killing squaws and papooses at Ash Hollow, he said, "They are nits and will become lice, and it is better to kill them in their chrysalis stage." Okay, Indians are insects. Reportedly, the soldiers at Ash Hollow took a baby Indian from its wounded mother, set it up, and used it for target practice. So the parallels to Huntsville Massacre are intriguing. So leaving the Ash Hollow case aside for the moment, in all three of the other cases, the massacres occurred after a peace settlement. In all three cases, the perpetrators looked on their deed as a moral good and proudly told about it afterwards. In all three cases, the perpetrators were morally supported by their communities. In the cases of the Hans Mill and Sand Creek massacres, state militia volunteers were involved. In all three cases, children were killed. Chivington's religious background would have also struck a chord for 19th century Latter-day Saints. Extermination language used by Boggs in his infamous extermination order and by Sidney Rigdon in his 4th of July speech was also frequently used by whites to describe desired warfare against Indians. And we saw that in the Tom Quick story. After I'd made my last corrections to Fire and the Sword, I exchanged some emails with Paul Reeve, who wrote that wonderful book about Paiutes in southern Nevada, and found that he'd been researching along similar lines. And his forthcoming book will go into this subject in much greater depth. Incidentally, this is getting into the memoir part here, we might ask, how did I research, how did I sleuth out these rhetorical patterns of language used in the Huntsville Massacre? Looking for parallels in Indian massacres might seem logical now, but it wasn't obvious to me at the beginning. So my answer is, how did I figure this out? I started by putting "nits make lice" with quotes around it into Google. This may seem unscholarly, but it isn't really. It only shows how the internet has revolutionized scholarly research in some ways. If I had undertaken the same project years ago, finding the rhetorical background to that phrase, I might have searched in the library for weeks or months before finding my answer. Unless I was interested in Indian history in America, I might never have found it. If I was lucky, I might have met someone who happened to know that connection. However, of course, as any serious researcher knows, doing a Google search is often only the beginning of your research, and you have to dig into primary documents in a number of libraries and archives to fill in the story. uncritical use of the internet can lead to any number of embarrassing mistakes. However, even in the case of poring over primary documents, which formerly had meant long, expensive trips to archives far from home, now the internet can sometimes supply you with real, valuable primary documents. When I was finishing, as I thought, final corrections on this book, and there were about three stages of doing what I thought were final corrections, I found Mormon War Papers, 1837 to 1841, an online source at the Missouri State Archives webpage. And this included numerous documents from the 1838 war in holograph form, with both images and transcriptions. So that's like a gold mine. And there you have the actual primary texts. This allowed me to correct the text of many documents Gentry had quoted at length. In a number of complex last-minute corrections that Lloyd Erickson good-naturedly worked into the text. When I checked this website recently, many documents that I used have apparently been taken offline, which is another danger for internet research, as the internet often changes. Another online treasure I found from the Missouri State Archives was Soldiers Database, War of 1812 to World War I, which included a section on the Mormon War. With this database, you can look up rank and file non-Mormon soldiers in the 1838 war, which was occasionally invaluable in identifying otherwise obscure participants in the conflict. To return to the new subjects I dealt with in my addenda, so that was a long introduction to one of them, the Nits Make Lice issue. In the addendum to the Danite chapter, and here, once again, Gentry gets a lot of credit for opening the discussion of the scholarly discussion of Danites in Missouri, because often Mormons had simply denied that Mormons had been involved with Danite activities. And Gentry found in the sources, in the sympathetic sources, that Mormons were organized as Danites. There was no way to deny it. And so he has a full chapter on the Danites. So in the addendum to the Danite chapter, I examine whether Joseph Smith knew Danite passwords and had been formally initiated as a Danite. I conclude that it was not absolutely certain that he knew Danite passwords, because the Lumen Shurtleff account of his using passwords might refer to military camp passwords. However, the research of Gentry, Alexander Baugh, and D. Michael Quinn shows that Joseph Smith attended Danite meetings in Far West and Adam Ondi Ammon, and actively supported the organization. On the other hand, we can't assume that Smith knew all the excesses that Danites taught and practiced. I also looked at whether Smith was a military leader during this period, something which some Mormons later denied, and conclude that he was, acting as a sort of general. I talked about this in my Sunstone paper last year, and I recommend that you dig up that tape, because Mike Quinn responded to the paper. Next subject. As I was working on this project, I knew, like everyone, that Richard Bushman's biography of Joseph Smith was going to appear. It finally did appear in 2005. Like everyone else, with very few exceptions that I know of, I read it and admired many things about it. The enormous breadth of Bushman's knowledge of American history, his willingness to deal openly with Joseph Smith's polygamy, the way he introduced many difficult issues in Joseph's history to a wide conservative Mormon readership, as well as non-Mormons. I was and am deeply impressed by Bushman's willingness to come to grips with the work of Mormon historians such as Dan Vogel, who look at important issues in Mormon history differently than he does. Many conservative Mormon historians either ignore an author like Vogel or attack him. So for me, Bushman has kind of taken the place of Leonard Arrington as a bridge between liberals and conservatives in Mormon history. However, when Richard Bushman's biography appeared, I quickly turned to the section on Missouri to see how he dealt with the numerous controversial subjects related to Joseph Smith, and was disappointed by that section of the book, as it seemed that he had not dealt with the era in depth. In addition, he treated Smith as sort of a passive onlooker during this period. He describes him as, quote, uncustomarily passive, unquote, in 1838 Missouri, quote, leaving a power vacuum for Sidney Rigdon, Sampson Avard, who was the leader of the Danites, and Lyman White to fill, end quote. When war broke out in the fall, quote, This is Bushman. Joseph remained in the background, more buffeted by events than directing their course, end quote. However, Gentry and Stephen Le Sueur both portray Smith as a dominant, active figure in Missouri, which I believe is more in line with Smith's general character. I hope Bushman can return to Joseph Smith in 1838 Missouri sometime and deal with the subject at greater length. Okay, let's see.
You're doing okay. You got at least 5 minutes.
Okay, it's significant that secular politics was a major cause of the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri. For example, the first non-Mormon violence in the conflict took place at a polling place in Gallatin as Mormons attempted to vote. In other words, Mormons were tolerated as a religious group, but as a religious group with political power, they were feared. This situation was exacerbated by many factors: a sudden influx of Mormons, largely from Yankee states, but also from Canada into Missouri; the fact that pre-Mormon Missouri had a largely southern population, you know, who had come from the south; the fact that the non-Mormons expected, probably correctly, that Mormons would vote as a bloc, as guided by a charismatic religious leader. One moral for modern Mormonism: if Mormons tend to be 90% Republicans, this will not serve the church well in the long run. Finally, 1838 Missouri saw Smith and other leading Mormons become increasingly disillusioned with secular law and politics. Partially as a result, in Missouri, Mormons began to follow what historian D. Michael Quinn calls theocratic ethics, in which church members accepted that the laws of God's kingdom should take precedence over the laws of the land. In addition, Mormon belief in literal political kingdom of God that would supplant earthly kingdoms also contributed to this perspective. In Missouri, Danitism exemplifies this. It took its name from the prophecy of Dan, in which the kingdom of God breaks down all other kingdoms. Daniel chapter 2. Okay. Many of the problems church leaders faced in Missouri were direct outgrowths of conflicts that had arisen in Kirtland. In Kirtland, many circumstances, including the failure of the Kirtland Safety Society anti-banking company, had caused widespread opposition to Smith and Rigdon, even among church leaders such as Oliver Cowdery and some apostles. Joseph Smith was faced with a number of frivolous lawsuits, which helped create his intense disillusionment with the law system. Mormon leaders became so skeptical of the legal process that the practice of law, becoming an attorney, nearly became grounds for excommunication in Missouri. For example, the 7th formal charge against Oliver Cowdery in his excommunication trial on April 12, 1838, in Far West was, quote, "for leaving the calling in which God had appointed him by revelation for the sake of filthy lucre and turning to the practice of law." Okay, that's a formal charge in an excommunication trial. And how many Mormon leaders would we excommunicate if we were still using
most of the top 15?
If we were still using that principle. Just for context, Mormon leaders often had other professions, such as farming and printing, so we see how the legal profession is being singled out here. While I was working on these issues, Levina recommended an article I had never read. And this is one other example of how important Levina was in helping produce this book. And it's Dale W. Adams' Grandison Newell's Obsession, which became really crucial to me in viewing Joseph Smith's attitudes toward the legal system. And Adams agreed that Joseph Smith was attacked by frivolous, groundless lawsuits in Kirtland. However, he argued that Smith had a good place for winning these lawsuits, a good case for winning these lawsuits, and his accusers might have been liable under barratry laws that penalize groundless legal harassment. But instead of staying in Kirtland, hiring a good lawyer, and fighting these cases in the law court, Smith and Sidney Rigdon fled Missouri for Missouri in March 1838. Thoroughly disenchanted with the legal system, Smith was reported as saying in a speech on October 15, 1838, "The law we have tried long enough. Who is so big a fool as to cry the law? The law, when it is always administered against us and never in our favor. I do not intend to regard the law hereafter, as we are made a set of outlaws by having no protection from it. We will take our affairs into our own hands and manage for ourselves. So this kind of a policy is kind of a double-edged sword, as you find out when you read the history of the 1838 war. Outrageously extra-legal occurrences, such as the Hans Mill Massacre and the expulsion of Mormons from Missouri in early 1839, show that Smith's attack on the justice of Missouri law was somewhat based on fact. Of course, Mormons arguably inflamed the 1838 conflict with such actions as that were also extra-legal, such as the Battle of Crooked River. One of the realities of the frontier in America was that the further west you went, the weaker the legal system became, which is why vigilante justice was often practiced in the West, rather than costly, time-consuming incarceration and trials. In addition, in Missouri, the majority of the residents were non-Mormons and Southern in their sympathies and culture. And often minorities were awarded less than full justice in frontier legal systems. Thus, in one sense, Joseph Smith and the Mormons would have been better off staying in the Northeast rather than in far west Missouri, which was right on the frontier of America at the time. One more paragraph. The Mormon disillusionment with secular law and politics led to further occasional rejections of and struggles with secular and political law in Nauvoo and Utah, including the Council of 50 in Nauvoo and Utah, the practice of polygamy, and Brigham Young's defiance of a U.S. president and the U.S. Army during the Utah War. I believe if you want to understand these important historical events and institutions in Utah and Mormon history, the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri provides absolutely essential background. But it's a tremendous story in its own right. As I wrote in the introduction, quote, "The Mormon experience in Missouri was a fascinating, tragic, gripping, sometimes violent story, providing important background for much of subsequent Mormon history. It shows the Mormons and non-Mormons at their heroic best and at their violent, militaristic worst. In the case of non-Mormons, for instance, we find both Doniphan's courageous stand against the illegal execution of Mormon leaders and also the brutal extermination order and Hans Mill Massacre. In the case of the Mormons, we find both their communitarian idealism and industry, their heroism in the face of an extermination order as they left Missouri, and, on the other hand, their excesses when raiding Davies County as Danites. This story shows many Mormons as innocent victims and others acting with misguided rashness. It is a story of the American frontier where legal niceties were often ignored." Thank you.
We have about 12 minutes for questions for Todd.
In looking at Le Sueur's book and all these other sources, have you come to any different conclusions than they have? Any new startling knowledge?
That's called revelation.
Just kind of the things I researched on my own for the addenda. I tend to agree with a lot of Steve Le Sueur's stuff, what he's written. Alexander Baugh's book is wonderful too, and he teaches at BYU, and he tends to be a little bit more conservative, but he's a wonderful researcher, and so I often relied on him, especially when, you know, there was something where I felt it would be great to have a little conservative support for something. My research on the Danites and whether Joseph Smith was a Danite is totally original with me, I think. And also the research on Nitz McLice, I haven't seen that in other publications. You know, and now someone will come up to me after and said, "Oh, you didn't see this this article that was published that covers exactly the same ground." A lot of what I did was small things that, you know, small corrections, like correcting the texts that Gentry quoted. And I don't expect people to actually see that as a major thing, but to me, it was very important. And, you know, sometimes when you go back to the original text after something's been printed, you look at the original text and, you know, like 95% may be exactly the same, and then you find out a sentence that didn't make sense at all makes sense in the original text. And I found that a couple times. Mark, yeah.
Todd, I'm just curious. I remember when I wrote my doctoral dissertation, I was so absolutely certain I was right on it. But about a month ago, just out of curiosity, I got it back up and I just shook my head. Like, how could I break that? Did you encounter that same type of experience with Leland Gentry, and then not feel? I know you said you prefaced this. I appreciate your explanation, but could you not just go through this kind of struggle? How did you accommodate that struggle? Leland's mm-hmm. work was, as you say, late 50s, and you know, it's a half century that takes place. And our understanding, you know, has just been so revolutionary, but it's we're so far advanced. How did you go through the decision-making process as to what you felt you needed to change, but yet still leave the Gentry imprimatur? I'd like you to develop that a little bit more, because I think that's a fascinating area.
Yeah. Again, in the addenda, at the end of each chapter, I quoted, you know, I tried to make it kind of like a showing the bibliography the important bibliography that had occurred on these subjects after Gentry wrote. And so, you know, there's some of my own research, but a lot of it is summarizing the debate among scholars, you know, after Gentry published. In the text itself, as I said, I generally kept Gentry's text as it was, except for small things like making it read more smoothly. When I disagreed with, sometimes I disagreed with him, and you know, like there's been a lot of water under the bridge since 1958, and so sometimes I would put, you know, in the addenda, I would say, okay, this is how the argument has gone since Gentry, and you know, I tend to side with Le Sueur here, you know, but there are other people who side with Gentry.
So this is as much a historiography.
There's piece, yeah, in the addenda, it is in many ways.
The only problem that people like me, like I'm going to have, is how do I footnote Todd Compton in Leland Gentry's addendum number, you know, that'll be a real challenge.
Yeah. Would you please submit any quotations from my book to me so I can authorize them? And not any of you, of course. I actually, you know, like in the footnotes in the addenda, it's pretty clear when I am talking, you could cite me or you could just cite the whole thing as Gentry and Compton, you know, to what year was it published this year? 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Three comments, two thank yous, and a question. First of all, Mark, thank you for reminding us that when we take out our dissertation, we're all shocked at how stupid we were.
I was going to say something about that too, but go ahead.
Yeah. My dissertation was on terrorism and how to become one and what it takes to be a terrorist. Hmm. I'm a behavior person, and I've been looking for your work on how the Mormons were terrorists for a long time. That's what you're doing. You're really studying how terrorism happens. And you've done an excellent job. You really have. And Mark's comment about giving credit where credit is due, I think, is very valid. It's a tough issue. And particularly in our tradition, to consider ourselves terrorists is a very uncomfortable thing. But if we're going to be truly objective, I think we need to look at our behavior for what it is. And you've given us another tool. I thought it looked sort of good.
In what sense are you talking about Mormons as terrorists? I don't.
A terrorist says the end justifies the means. Stop there.
Huh.
And then how we justify our behavior thereafter is just nits and lights. Hmm. And that's my second comment. Nits make lights. Mm-hmm. You're right. I appreciate your research on that. Mm-hmm. But what you're doing and have done with your entire career is taking nits and prevented them from becoming lights. Because you find out what really happened. And that way it changes the conversation. That's a significant contribution.
Hmm.
So my question, over the course of your career, I'm probably the oldest person in the room.
Oh, no.
I'll have a contest. I just looked at it.
It's
the caffeine, man. Better Living Through Addiction. I've got a whole title. Now, what changes have you seen in the willingness of the BYU scholar to pay attention? I would add Stephen Harper to your list, with Andrew Bach, for example. There are those in the Joe Smith paper project that I won't put on the paper, except for the guy that runs it. So it's kind of an interesting dilemma. Our generation is, my generation is now pretty well dying out. Yours is catching up. The person I heard yesterday is
older. I'm older than I look, too, by the way. Go ahead.
It's an interesting problem. It's an interesting problem, because if we're going to be truly, truly what we claim to be, and that's honest, I think we have to pay attention to the sort of things you pay attention to, the way you do it. How many other people have you seen doing it your way in the conservative side of things? Do you see a movement?
You know, it's really hard to generalize. You know, some on the conservative side, I see a lot of hope for. You know, and others, they're just very conservative and won't break out of that. But you know, part of being conservative is, you know, really conservative is being honest, I think. And so a lot of them realize that. So as I say, I have a lot of respect for the work of Alexander Baugh. You know, I have a lot of respect for Richard Bushman as it came through. You know, even though I, you know, disagree with him about some things, obviously, and I disagree with him on some of his treatment of Joseph Smith and polygamy. Obviously, you know, any two scholars who deal with the subject will disagree. You know, but it's pretty amazing what he accomplished in that book. You know, with the audience of conservative Mormons. I mean, my bishop, you know, I came into a ward and I'd been there a couple of weeks, and my bishop came up to me and said, "Oh, are you the Todd Compton in footnote to Richard Bushman?" You know, and other conservative historians won't even put me in a footnote.
Yeah.
You know, so I see hope in some ways among, you know, in the mainstream church. You know, obviously they're not as out on, you know, the barricades as some scholars are. But, you know, I see hope with some people. And I think it looks like the Joseph Smith Papers Project is starting to turn out well. You know, I had skepticism about it at first, but, you know.
Well, there's an interesting quote used in the hard sciences when they're considering Nobel candidates, and they use it a lot when they're trying to pick against the Nobel. The quote is, "The most significant contribution to the advancement of science is the funeral."
Yes. I won't go any further with that. In public, at least.
Was your great-great-grandfather Jedediah Grant in Missouri during this war?
Yeah, my great-great-grandfather is Jedediah Morgan Grant.
Oh.
Yeah.
Can you?
And I share all of his personal, you know, qualities also. Yeah. I'm a total fanatic.
You do not.
The fire. The fire part of the fire.
Actually, he had a very domestic, loving, tender side that people don't realize about, and you can see that in Gene Sessions' biography of him. But obviously, he also had the other fiery Reformation Brigham's Hammer side. So it's kind of fun to go back and read his sermons and think, gee, I'm related to this guy. Yeah.
So I think Alex Baugh argues that extermination might have been removed beyond the borders instead of kill. Richard Bennett was in Nauvoo a couple weeks ago. He seemed not quite convinced. What's your take on that?
I'd kind of... Yeah, I wouldn't be. I mean, in practical terms, maybe that's what Boggs meant, if you'd have, you know, nailed him down. Said, "What do you mean by this?" It's like, yes, we want to get them out of Missouri. But it's extreme language. It's you know, the language is too extreme. And as I say, it's common in rhetoric used against American Indians.
But the quote you used from the American Indian, I think it was in New York,
right,
included something like exterminate from the area, or
yeah, well, it was like Tom Quick wanted to make sure there were no Indians where he was hunting, you know, in his area. And so, but I didn't put it in here, and in fact, it's not in this book. It's like post-research, post-book, and there's, I think there'll be a lot of it in Reeves' book, but there was a lot of the language of extermination when talking about Indians. You know, it's like, this is what we need to do, exterminate them. It's like they're insects, you know. It's like an extermination campaign.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of language used by Boggs and by Sidney Rigdon was too extreme. That, you know, it was wrong. It was treating people, dehumanizing people. Mark.
Yeah, well, that when Rigdon, he's using that term months before Boggs wrote it.
And people think that he was using it defensively, which you can look into his statement, but, you know.
In the context of the emotion of that 4th of July speech and what he is rallying the people to do is not, at least the way I interpret that speech, it's not an attempt to remove the Gentiles from Caldwell County.
That doesn't seem to be what Rigdon is saying.
Well,
that is not. I don't think that is what Rigdon is saying.
Well, what he's it's a very patriotic speech, and he says it's either us or them.
Yeah, I'm saying I wouldn't extend the Baugh argument to what Rigdon is saying. It doesn't seem to fit.
I think we have to be very careful about presentism as well, about injecting our early 21st century understanding of extermination in a way to try to rationalize away the emotions of the time through redefining what people are trying to say. It's really important to understand the context and the purpose of the phraseology. At least that's the way I would.
Yeah, I am curious, Todd, how do you, because as Locke pointed out, Baugh seems to suggest that Boggs, in his order, is talking about a removal, not an actual extinction in the sense of massacre, but it's a removal that these people have got. How do you feel about
it? Well, I think in practical terms, that's what he was talking about.
Okay.
We've got to remove Mormons. Yeah. But he could have used it without using
that
extermination.
Word, the word, yeah.
And I think it's kind of like an alternative. It's like, if you do not remove, you know, extermination.
Isn't the first definition of exterminate, remove, the 1828 Webster's?
That's his argument, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's Baugh's, right. I think it is.
Yeah, and again, I'm not convinced by that. You know, like in the language of the Indian Wars, where they use the term extermination, I don't think they're using it as, okay, we're going to remove them, you know, to South America or something. They're talking about getting rid of them.
In that case, why does the Boggs order put exterminated or driven from the state?
Yeah, it's an either or thing.
I mean, if exterminate means to remove,
or else why does he list
that? Why does he make it a binary thing? Right.
Yeah.
Well, as I read it though, now again, I was pretty convinced by Baugh's argument in that. He's using it together, that he wasn't making a qualifier. Now that's the way I, you know, as I read the order, that was. But
and again, we should look at his actual language, but.
Yeah.
But that would ruin a good conversation, wouldn't it? To actually look at the text, the evidence.
John, you had a comment.
I was just going to say, on the one hand, Mark's comment about presentism and extermination is that we now have, you know, from our perspective, we have a lot of examples of much more recent modern exterminating capacity and systematic states, you know, where modern states, for example, in World War II, were able to do some very systematic scientific extermination. In a different sense than would have been possible in frontier Missouri. In other words, where nobody even in that sense could even imagine such a thing, because the state had no capacity to do anything like that. And that's, I think, that was an important point for Mark's presentism. I had one question about although I have the did the cover and
Mark, maps. By the way, yes, you did wonderful maps.
But the maps are covered. Fantastic.
Thank you, but Grant hasn't actually given me one of the books itself yet, so I can't. I don't know the answer to this. But is there, you were talking about how there's a lot of Southern character, you know, from the South, the immigration into Missouri. But Missouri, I always feel like is also a muddy state, which is pulled. You know, it's in the center of a lot of things now, or in the center between North. It's a border state, and I was wondering if there was something in there that in the book in Gentry's work or what the addendum is in terms of actually doing some kind of a census work where we really know what the character is. I know we always tend to say there's a Southern character, but there's also the river there, and there's a difference between. You know, Jackson County and Clay County, you know, in even a northern and southern spectrum there, and even just by naming one after Jackson and one after Clay, you immediately, you know, like are even seeing the divide.
This is a great article. Write it. But no, he doesn't deal with it, and I don't deal with that. But
yeah, I was just wondering.
These would be very interesting things to go into in greater depth.
Yeah. So could I add just something
sure.
about that? That Stevens' article that was in Journal of Mormon History on Caldwell County, what he points out is that the part that the Mormons got was actually the land that nobody else wanted. It was the wooded, the rocky. It didn't have the good soil for planting and things, which was the original intent was to give them all of that. So all the way up, I think, to the border, right, Mark?
Or Well, I did a bunch of stuff on mapping of Caldwell County and things like that too. And I think that, I mean, what you've got with the when you're doing those counties like you're up to the border, you don't no county, you know, the counties aren't actually going up to the border. You set it up where that part of the land up there is attached to the county for you know, legal purposes
right.
and judicial purposes.
Right.
But the county would never have been much bigger. Than it is, it would have had the Buncombe Strip. In other words, this part that eventually got attached instead to Ray County. So it would have been a little bit bigger, maybe, but it wouldn't have been too much bigger.
Well, Stephen says it would have been double, actually.
Well, you're referring to Davies County, which is the northern part.
But the Mormons were supposed to get all of that originally.
All of Davies and all of Culp.
Yeah.
But it depends on what you mean by originally, right?
So
there was a proposal that was made by the Missourians who are working on making a compromise with the local Mormon leaders, and they're essentially suggesting to the Mormons, they're like, look, we'll give you a county, and it's not a bad county, it's a fine county, and we'll give it to you here, which would have been the Buncombe Strip plus Caldwell County, and then we'll attach the northern part for that purpose. The people who were anti-Mormon instead immediately organized two counties. And so Davies County is organized to lock the Mormons in, and that is an aggressive move. But on the other hand, but Donovan said, look, as much as our compromise is, you know, all of essentially around here, we're not going to go into these other counties, that's still kind of open for grabs, and that was definitely one of the things because that's unclear what's going on up north, that's one of the grounds for the war, because there's this unclearness about the compromise.
The Strip was to be a demilitarized zone. With Ray County and Caldwell County too,
right.
which set the precedent for the Crooked Creek
Battle of Crooked River.
Sure,
Crooked River.
Though it was administered by Ray, so
but it was
formally.
Yeah. That's where the militia was too.
Yeah.
But they set up their defenses along there.
Now I'm just curious. You people from Missouri will know this better than me. What part did play? Missouri play in the Civil War?
Divided.
There's a battle on the tip a lot.
Didn't secede. Huh. Didn't formally secede, but was divided.
Well, do you mean formally divided, or what do you mean?
Well, practically, de facto, the St. Louis area was staunchly pro-Northern. That's where Ulysses Grant, had his area, the strong German Lutheran. But the further west you go, the more... pro-south, so you went. It's a classic border state.
But where's more? But you're also across the river. More of the people, like Donovan, are being drawn in from more Union side, and then on the Jackson County side, it's more southern sentiment, right?
You've got to be careful because you're dividing the issues based on slavery. Yeah. Secession was a really dominant issue at the time, and that was so important. And also in 1856, there's a civil war occurring on the border between Kansas Territory and Missouri. So, and that, as I say, predates by 3 or 4 years the actual framework for what would, the entire nation would become inflamed in. That happened in two different locations, also on the Virginia-Maryland border, which is another border area. But it's really important to understand the dynamics that are going on that eventually lead to this same social dysfunction once the Missouri Mormons leave. I mean, things don't get any better. If anything, they devolve.
Well, this will be a great work to do census work on the non-Mormons, you know, before the Mormons came and during the Mormon period also. So that would be great work for someone to do, if any of you out there. And it might be good for you who are in Missouri to do that kind of work. It's kind of hard for me to do it, even with the internet out here.
A couple of things I should have pointed out. One is that I actually grabbed the book from Benchmark Books. I left my copy in the room. But so if you're interested in getting the book, Benchmark has it. Todd's here. You can sign it. As a book collector, that's the most important thing. And just a little hint, you only have the author's sign and date. Don't have them put your name on it. You ruin the book at that point. my criticism of the book, I looked at the book from a critic's point of view as I read it, and I really wish there was more of Todd in the book. Now, Todd disagrees with me because he felt that it was important. And those who have not seen the book, Todd does an amazing job of allowing Gentry to speak and allowing that to be uninfluenced by his editing. I was amazed at how great of a job he did at doing that. But I would like to have personally seen more Todd. I think Todd, again, as I said, I think Todd's a brilliant author and scholar, and I would like to have seen that. In talking with Stephen Lesueur about the book, he informed me that it actually, well, Gentry played a major role in him writing about Missouri. And Stephen said to me, he said the Gentry's dissertation is one of the best. And that sort of gets to Mark's question about that the legs it has, that it can be published in 2011 and still be important. But I think Todd's work allows for that, too. I guess that was all the criticism I had. I love the book. The book is beautiful. As a book lover, Kofor did an excellent job at publication. John's maps are fantastic.
It's worth buying just for John's maps.
Yeah. And Todd's addendum.
Check that book entirely by its cover.
That's right.
You did the cover of my book too, and it's great.
Mike Marquardt said to me, he goes, I only read Todd's addendums.
you're really missing something if you do that.
I know. Well, I think he had read Gentry's.
Yeah. Before.
Anyway, so, but it's an amazing book. We have 1 minute left, or we can stop.
Congratulations, Todd.
Yeah, Todd. Yeah.